Before I turn the class over to Brother Roger, he's asked that we read from the book of Exodus, Exodus the third chapter. And we'll read the first six verses. That's Exodus 3, verses 1 to 6. Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush was burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt. And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here am I. And he said, Draw not nigh hither. Put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of thy father, and the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. So with that, brothers and sisters and young people, it's my pleasure to turn the class over to Brother Roger. Brother Roger.
Thank you, Brother Chairman, and good morning, my dear brothers and sisters and young people. In our studies on God manifestation over the course of Saturday, we dealt with the very phrase that comes out of Exodus 3 and verse 6, where it says, I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And it was because of that particular phrase, and based on that particular set of words, that our studies on God manifestation were constructed over the weekend. And of course there's a context to the phrase, because it sits inside another story, doesn't it? And that story is the story of the burning bush, of these few verses in Exodus chapter 3. And so it seemed appropriate to perhaps have a little class on the matter of the burning bush, just so that we have the context in which the very phrase, I'm the God of Abram and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob, came into being. On the first occasion it was to be heard here in Exodus chapter 3. You know, the record says in this first verse that Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert and came to the mountain of God. And it was when he came to the mountain of God that this special manifestation would occur in the life of Moses. But I think it's important to understand that the background to this moment of revelation before Moses, the man of God, is the story of his shepherding care in Exodus chapter 3 and verse 1. You know, it says, you see, that he kept the flock. And because he kept the flock, what that meant in reality was that Moses spent most of his life alone. He was out somewhere in the wilderness with the sheep. He knew a life of loneliness. And he also knew the life of discipline and the life of patience that was a shepherd's life in the vast solitude of the wilderness. In fact, most of his life, Moses was alone. And the interesting thing is that he'd been placed in that environment, brothers and sisters, in the environment of loneliness for 40 years before he ever saw the burning bush. In fact, if you come to the Acts of the Apostles, you might know this, but in the Acts of the Apostles, we're told specifically that concerning the the apportioning of Moses' life, Acts 7 will say this. It breaks his life, doesn't it? Breaks his life up into sections of 40. Because Acts 7 will say in verse 23, "And when he was full 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel." So the first section, the first stage of Moses' life was from the moment of his birth, brought up in Pharaoh's household, to the time when he was full 40 years old, verse 23, "and it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel." But that's only the first 40 years of his life, because verse 30 will go on to say, "And when 40 years were expired, there appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai an angel of the Lord in a flame of fire in a bush." And then verse 36 says, "He brought them out after that he'd showed wonders and signs in the land of Egypt and in the Red Sea and in the wilderness 40 years." These three 40 years are all different. And in fact, that's confirmatory of what we hear, is it not, brothers and sisters, when we read in the record of Deuteronomy, right at the end of his life, what does it say of Moses? Deuteronomy chapter 34 and verse 7, that Moses was 120 years old, it says. And it's the three 40s of Acts chapter 7, you see, verse 23, verse 30, verse 36. Moses is 120 years old, says Deuteronomy 34, verse 7. So before he ever saw this burning of the bush in Exodus chapter 3 and verse 1, he'd been alone in the wilderness for 40 years in preparation for this moment when Yahweh would be manifested to him in this special way. And I think there's a lesson here, you see, as the story of Exodus 3 begins to unfold. Why would we expect to receive the blessing of Yahweh's flame, visible to our own eyes, without some similar spirit of probation in our lives to prepare us for that moment when the power of God will be manifested in his word unto us? I think there's a story here, you see, about our preparation in the things of the truth. In effect, what we're being told is that the revelation of the burning bush of Exodus 3 will only happen to those who, like Moses, have journeyed into the wilderness to be alone with God. They're the only people who will ever see the burning bush. If we want to see the burning bush that burns with the splendor of Yahweh's fire, then we will need to go out into the wilderness, because that's the only place where we can see it. And of course it says, does it not, in Exodus 3 and verse 2, it says, "The angel of Yahweh appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush, and he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed." Now, of course, what's interesting is that it wasn't God himself in the bush, was it? The deity was manifest on this occasion because he revealed himself through an angel. And so verse 2 will say it was the angel of Yahweh. And it will be described as an angel. And yet, interestingly enough, even though it's the angel of Yahweh in verse 2, it also says in verse 4, "And when Yahweh saw that he turned aside to see," and then it will say, "Elohim called unto him out of the midst of the bush." So it's an angel, verse 2, it's Yahweh, verse 4, and it's Elohim, verse 4. And since the angel represents all the mighty ones of Baal, both present and future, what we've got bound up here is the doctrine of God manifestation by means of his mighty ones, through whom he will indeed be revealed. And on this occasion, as the record says, it was an angel of Yahweh. In fact, doesn't this remind us of Psalm 104 and verse 4, "Who maketh his angels..." Now, what does the passage say? "Spirits, even a flaming fire." And that's what was seen in the bush, you see. The flaming fire in the bush was the angel that was manifest on this occasion to Moses. In fact, there's another similar passage. That's Psalm 104, verse 4. But there's a similar passage, which, again, we shan't turn up, but I'll just quote it to you. "For it came to pass, when the flame went up toward heaven from off the altar, that the angel of Yahweh ascended in the flame of the altar." Judges 13, verse 20. And because angels are divine manifestations of power, they are able to see, they are able to be manifested in the very flame itself. What Moses saw, I think, brothers and sisters, was not just a flame. He saw a flaming being. He saw an angel. It's like Genesis 3, verse 24. He placed at the Garden of Eden cherubim, even a flaming sword. So he was an angel manifested as a flaming fire. Now, whatever the flame represented, brothers and sisters, on this occasion of angelic manifestation, the fire of Exodus 3, verse 2, can't represent the fire of destruction, can it? Because we're going to be expressly told that whatever the flame did and whatever the flame was, that the bush was not consumed. So I think the fire perhaps represents several things. One of the principles that perhaps it represents is the flame of that which purifies. It doesn't destroy, but it purifies. And I also think it represents God as a jealous God. Do you know that in Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 24, which is quoted by the apostle later on, we will read these words, that God is a consuming fire, even a jealous God. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 24. He's a jealous God that demands all our worship of him. And yet, although it says that God is a consuming fire, on this occasion, Exodus 3, verse 2, we're expressly told that the bush was not consumed. So whatever the fire was, it's not the fire that destroys. And notice where the fire is seen. Verse 2. It says that the fire of this flaming angel was actually revealed in the midst of the bush. And again in verse 4. In the midst of the bush. So the flaming fire was to be found in the very bush itself. So what does the bush represent? And it's obviously important, because how many times is the bush mentioned here? Well, it's mentioned in verse 2, once, twice, three times, again in verse 3, and again in verse 4. So it's going to be used five times in this particular little passage. And it's always going to be called, not just a bush, but the bush in the Hebrew, ha-sena, the bush. So famous in Moses' experience and in his later instructions that the whole nation of Israel would simply refer to the bush and know instantly what that meant. Every Jewish heart thrilled to the story of Moses at the bush of the burning. And the word bush here in verse 2 means, a senna means to prick or to pierce. And so Stanley suggests that it was probably the thorny acacia tree. It was one of the very trees of the desert. And perhaps the lesson of Exodus 3 and verse 2 is this, brothers and sisters, that when God chose to be manifest in this way, in the flaming fire that was in the very midst of the bush, it wasn't the noble cedar tree. It wasn't some other mighty tree. It was the humble thorn bush, which was but a plant of the wilderness. The tabernacle of the divine majesty was not some glorious temple, but a thorn bush in the desert. And yet in that thorn bush, God was pleased to reveal himself. But it wasn't any thorn bush, was it? It was a plant that represented the nation of Israel and the ultimate destiny of the Israel of God. Why was the bush not consumed? Well, because that nation, Israel, whatever might happen to it down through time in terms of its difficulties and its privations, that nation would never be consumed. Because through that nation and in the midst of that nation would Yahweh's glory be forever revealed. And so the fire in the bush represents the divine majesty manifested in and through his people. And if the bush represents the people of God, and the purpose of the bush is that Yahweh's flame might be seen in the midst of it, then that bush will always be needed, and so the flame might always burn. The very purpose for which God had called Israel so that they might manifest him was the guarantee that they could never be destroyed. So three passages that just might help in that regard, with regard to the promise of the bush that might never be consumed in that way. If you come to Jeremiah chapter 46 and verse 18, here's one of three passages which are probably helpful to have in the margin of Exodus chapter 3. The bush was not consumed. It's an explanation, perhaps, of what the passage means. Because the bush represents the people of God through whom Yahweh's glory will always be revealed. So Jeremiah 46 and verse 28 says, "Fear thou not, O Jacob, my servant, saith Yahweh, for I am with thee, for I will make a full end of all the nations whither I have driven thee. But I will not make a full end of thee, but correct thee in measure, yet will I not leave thee wholly unpunished." You see, the nation was to go through matters of correction at the hand of their God, and yet the promise of God to Israel always was and always would be that he would never make a full end of them. And in that sense, the bush would not finally be consumed. God would never make a full end of his nation, precisely because they were to be the instruments by which he would be revealed and manifested to the nations. And the second passage, which is quite helpful in that regard, is Malachi chapter 3. Do you remember that little verse in Malachi chapter 3? So helpful in terms of its connection here with the spirit of the story of the burning bush. When it says in Malachi chapter 3 and verse 6, these words, "For I am Yahweh, I change not. Therefore, ye sons of Jacob are not consumed," said the prophet. "Therefore, ye sons of Jacob are not consumed. I am Yahweh, I change not. My everlasting purpose is to be revealed in my people. Therefore, the bush is not consumed." And that's the precise testimony of Malachi chapter 3. And one last one in Isaiah chapter 43. Perhaps this is the most famous one of all of them, really, and certainly highly relevant to the testimony of the teaching of the burning bush. Do you remember what it says in Isaiah 43, verses 1 and 2? Actually, really, probably the first seven verses are appropriate, but perhaps just reading verses 1 and 2 this time, and perhaps verse 7. Isaiah 43 says, verse 1, "But now thus saith Yahweh that created thee, O Jacob, and he that formed thee, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed thee. I have called thee by name. Thou art mine. When thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee, and through the rivers they shall not overflow thee. And when thou walkest through the fire, thou shalt not be burned. Neither shall the flame kindle upon thee, because these people," verse 7, "were every one called by his name and created for God's glory and formed for that purpose. So they'll never be consumed, because in them, as symbolized by the angel, God's glory would be manifest." So coming back to Exodus chapter 3, the record goes on to tell us in the third verse that when Moses, on this occasion in the wilderness, saw this bush, he was, of course, and quite naturally so, consumed with interest as to what it might mean. And so the record says in verse 3, Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. You see, I think there's a tremendous lesson here, because, again, if you come back to Acts chapter 7, now this is Stephen's dissertation upon the spirit of the burning bush. And this is what Acts says, what Stephen says, about the attitude of Moses on this occasion. And I think there's a wonderful lesson here concerning Moses, the man of God. And it's a lesson that's helpful for all of us to learn in terms of our attitude to spiritual things. Because Acts 7 says this, verse 31. When Moses saw it, the flame of fire in the bush, as verse 30 says, he wondered at the sight, and as he drew near to behold it, the voice of Yahweh came unto him, saying, I am the God of thy fathers. So Moses had an intense interest to know. He drew near to behold. See, I think there's a lesson here. You see, there are those who are drawn to the glory and wonder of divine manifestation, and there are those that are not. You see, Moses had an intense desire to know about the secret of the bush. He wasn't just content to know that the bush was burning. He wanted to know why the bush was burning. And he wanted to know why the bush was not consumed. See, Moses had a yearning to understand these things. Well, that's the spirit of the truth that we all need to have, isn't it? An endless curiosity to learn the principles of the truth. And isn't it interesting that when we come back to Exodus chapter 3, when it says in verse 3, Moses said, I will now turn aside, I will see this great sight. Why the bush is not burnt? Why is the bush not consumed, says Moses? I must needs know. And the record says, verse 4, and when Yahweh saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him. And here's the lesson. You see, the deity delighted in that spirit, which sought to understand the idea of how the Father would manifest himself. God delights in those who turn aside to see the bush. God loves that. God loves that spirit. When he saw that Moses had that interest to know and to learn and to understand, at that point, God said, I can respond to that, and he called to him. And of course, reading carefully verse 4, and when Yahweh saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him. Now, it's all how we read it, of course, isn't it? God called unto him. Well, it could be that, couldn't it? God called unto him. But it could be, and when Yahweh saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him. And you see, that's the lesson, isn't it, brothers and sisters, is that God's involvement in our lives is personal and individual. God called unto this man because of his spirit. And God calls to each of us out of the flaming bush. He calls unto us, provided we've gone out into the wilderness to see the bush and that we want to draw near to understand its secret. God will call to us in that place as well if we show that same spirit. If we seek to know the secret of God manifestation. And so verse 5 says, he said, draw not nigh hither, put thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. It's a funny thing, really, when you think about it, brothers and sisters, isn't it, is that it was just a place in the wilderness. This very bush might have been a place where Moses' own sheep had trodden all around it. And yet Moses comes to see, God calls, and suddenly Moses has got to take his shoes off. Just like that. And of course, the reason why he had to take his shoes off, because the record says the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. Do you know that's the first time the word holy appears in the scripture? First time. This is holy ground. And why was it holy, brothers and sisters? Why suddenly now was this place, this piece of land, this spot where the bush was. Why now, suddenly, was it holy? Well, it was holy because God was there. Be thou holy, for I am holy. There's only holiness with God, brothers and sisters. It comes from God and nowhere else. And so what made this place holy was it was the place where Yahweh had been pleased to manifest himself. And God's character and God's presence made it holy by virtue of the angel that flamed in this particular place. And I think there's a lesson here about that principle, you see. And because it was holy, made so by God's presence, well, he says to Moses, you better take your shoes off. Which is a strange thing, because we don't take our shoes off when we come to the meeting, do we? In fact, we probably put our shoes on. But the surprising thing is we probably put our shoes on when we come to the meeting for exactly the same reason that Moses was asked to take his shoes off. Because you see, why did they take shoes off in Old Testament times when they arrived at somebody's house? They took the shoes off, brothers and sisters, so as not to bring the dust and dirt of their travels into the house that they had been graciously permitted to enter. They took their shoes off as a mark of respect. They took their shoes off so as to leave the dirt of outside where it belonged. And so God says to Moses, I know you've wandered all over this wilderness, but where you are right now is my place, not yours. And I'm holy. So take your shoes off, because you're in my presence now. I think there's a lesson here, you see, perhaps about ecclesial life. The spirit of the age changes, doesn't it? Two generations ago, young people were brought up with a very strong spirit of communal responsibility. That we belong to a community, and that because we belong to a community, we do what is good for the community, and we think about the community. In fact, I can remember when I grew up in ecclesial life, and I'm sure the older brothers and sisters here will remember, you would never dream or dare of doing anything different in the meeting, unless you knew that it was okay. You checked first that there was approval or consent, that the arranging brethren knew, or that it had been discussed at an ecclesial meeting, so that you knew that the whole ecclesia had decided. But you would never come into the ecclesia and do a single thing that was different. You wouldn't do that. And rightly so, because our constitutions say, do they not? And one of our clauses, one of the very first clauses of the constitution of every ecclesia is, we mutually agree to submit to the arrangements preferred by the greater number. And now suddenly a generation who's arisen, at least in the world, who are driven by the spirit of humanism that says it's all about me, it's all about the right of the individual. And so now individuals do as they please and do as they want because, well, it's all about me. And that spirit perhaps could infect ecclesial life, couldn't it? Where suddenly people arrive and say, well, I'll wear whatever I'd like to wear because that's what I wear and that's what I want to wear. Or that's what I do, and that's what I want to do. And because that's what I do, and I wear, and I think, then that's what I will do. And we walk into the ecclesia and imagine that we've got the right to do that. And God says, no, you haven't. This is my house, not yours. The ecclesia is holy ground. And in places of holy ground, we act and think and speak and even dress according to divine protocols and not ours. And we don't walk into the house of God and say, well, this is how I like to dress, and so if it's good enough for me, it's good enough for God. No, it's not. It wasn't good enough for God on this occasion. Moses could have said, well, if my sandals are good enough to take me through the wilderness, then they should be good enough here for God. No, says God, they're not good enough. I have a protocol. Take them off. You're on holy ground now. Something that we should never forget about the things of the truth and the specialness of them. And of course, it's not just about dress, is it, brothers and sisters? It's about all those other manifestations of the flesh. That because the ecclesia is holy ground, that the more we remember that that's the case, that wherever God is, the ground is holy, then the more our behaviour should match that understanding, and that the ecclesia is not the place where there should be bickering. The ecclesia is not the place where there should be dispute. The ecclesia is not the place where there should be the spirit and the thinking of the flesh that should prevail. We're on holy ground, in God's house. And even Moses, the man of God, was bidden to understand that principle, you see, in what he was asked to do on this occasion of taking his sandals off. Actually, it's true, isn't it, that in Luke 15, verse 22, in the parable of the prodigal son, do you remember the first thing that the father asked of the son, or asked to be done to the son when he came back? They said, put a ring on his hand, and put a robe, and put some shoes on him. Put some sandals on him. Because who went bare feet in every house? The servants. So perhaps God is also saying to Moses, you're in my house now and you're my servant. So the sandals were taken off actually because it was a mark of respect for what God required. So when we come into the ecclesia, we ought to think and act and comport ourselves with regard to the principle always of respect for divine principles and divine standards, and that we do so together in the spirit of cooperation in the things of the truth. It's so important that we do that, brothers and sisters, in the work of ecclesial life. In fact, you can see the spirit of the man when it says this in verse 6, that having taken his sandals off now and come to this most holy place, the record says in verse 6, moreover, he said, the angel said, on behalf of God, I am the Elohim of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And so now it was revealed to him what the flaming fire in the bush was all about, that one day there would be a manifestation of mighty and holy ones through a father, first revealed in a son, and lastly in a multitude. And all of this symbolized in that phrase, I am the God of Abraham, the father, the God of Isaac, the special son, the God of Jacob, the multitudinous seed. And by this means, God's mystery of manifestation would be accomplished and revealed among his people. And the record says that when Moses heard this declaration, verse 6, he hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Actually, in the Acts record, it says Moses trembled, Acts 7 verse 32, Moses trembled and durst not behold. Do you know, I think it would be good to capture some of the spirit of Moses' attitude at the burning bush today, because we live in an age and in a culture so far removed from the tremblings of Moses the man of God. And as we move further away from that, the spirit of all that is sacred and all that is precious and all that is holy in the life of the truth gets lost. It's why, incidentally, we have dress standards. Whatever they might be, and I'm not sure what your ecclesia is, it doesn't matter. But it's why we have some dress protocol in ecclesial life. Because if everyone said, well, I'll just dress as I please, then what will happen is that incrementally, stage by stage, somehow, the sanctity of the meetings, the decorum of the meetings, the solemnity of the meetings disappears. You're not quite sure why, but it has. And it has because all the little things that go to make up the spiritual atmosphere of an ecclesia have been compromised and lost. And suddenly it's not a special place anymore. In fact, it doesn't even feel like holy ground. Guarding the place of the bush is one of the things that the people of God want to do. Guarding the place where the flame of Yahweh appears. Moses trembled and durst not behold. That is a good spirit for us to try and preserve, is it not, in ecclesial life. And of course, when we come to the Gospel of Luke and chapter 20, we will read this. concerning the significance of this episode, as our Lord Jesus Christ himself will expound it on the day of his answer to the Sadducees, who had posed to him a question they thought so clever at the time, but was so beautifully explained by Christ. It says in verse 27 of Luke 20, "Then came to him certain of the Sadducees, which deny that there is any resurrection. And they asked him, saying, Master, Moses wrote unto us, if any man's brother die having a wife, and he die without children, that his brother should take his wife and raise up seed unto his brother. There were therefore seven brethren. The first took a wife and died without children, and the second took her to wife, and he died childless, and the third took her, and in like manner the seven also, and they left no children and died, and last of all the woman died also. Therefore, in the resurrection, whose wife of them is she? For seven had her to wife." It's one of those clever things of Jewish argument and Jewish legalism, wherewith they thought to entrap the Lord, wasn't it? They all married her, so whose wife shall she be in the kingdom, in the resurrection? And the Lord gave a marvellous answer, didn't he? Because what he said was this. Verse 34, "Jesus answering said unto them, The children of this world marry and are given in marriage. But they which shall be accounted worthy to obtain that world and the resurrection from the dead, neither marry nor are given in marriage." So there's a contrast. In fact, did you see this? Verse 34. The children of this world, the children, verse 35, of that world. Did you notice that? This world and that world. The children of this world marry and are given in marriage. The children of that world, verse 35, neither marriage nor are given in marriage, but in fact, verse 36, they're made equal unto the angels, being the children of God and the children of the resurrection. Why do the saints of the age to come neither marry nor are given in marriage, verse 35? And the answer is, of course, because the saints will be made immortal. And if the saints are immortal, then they cannot bring forth mortal offspring. They're now immortal. So it's not possible for immortal saints to produce children that are still in the state of mortality. But it is also not possible for them to produce immortal children, because immortality belongs to God. Immortality is the underived essence of God. God alone has the sovereign right and the sovereign prerogative to say to whom immortality shall be given. And it's God's gift. It doesn't belong to anybody as of right. Immortality only belongs to those who have manifested the Father in their lives. And the Father immortalizes that spirit of him in their lives. And so it is not possible for the saints of the kingdom age to ever bring forth immortal children who own immortality by inherent right. It's morally impossible. So they will not have children. They cannot do so in the kingdom, says Jesus. So they won't marry. And because they won't marry, it is most likely that the organs of reproduction will disappear in the kingdom, because they won't be needed. And the bodily form of the saints of the age to come, the Elohim of the age to come, will in some measure be altered. But, says the Lord, what they will be is equal to the angels. And if the angels are the Elohim of the age to come, says Christ, if the angels are the Elohim of the present order of things and the present age, then the saints, made equal to the angels, are in fact the Elohim of the age to come. And the proof that they are the Elohim of the age to come, and that they will be made equal to the angels, well, says Christ, the proof why? Verse 37, "Now that the dead are raised, even Moses showed at the bush." Notice that definite article. Moses showed at the bush when he calleth the Lord the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. For he is not the God of the dead, but of the living, for all live unto him. And so what our Lord Jesus Christ taught is that these three men, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, all of whom were dead when the promise was given to Moses at the bush that God was their God, must therefore at some point live in the future in order for God to be their God. And in order to live in the future, they must be raised. But do you see how the record finishes? Verse 38 of Luke 20. For he's not a God of the dead, but of the living, for all live unto him. And what it's really saying is that when these are raised, the Elohim of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they will live everlastingly. They will live eternally. They'll live unto God forever. And suddenly we realize that these, therefore, are the flaming fire in the bush. They all live unto him. The bush is never consumed. It always burns, but it's always there. And the Elohim of the age to come, granted the flame of immortality, are they who will be part of that bush that will burn forever and yet somehow never ever be consumed. Interesting, you know, how many manifestations or experiences of divine theophanies did Moses have in his life? And the answer is many, don't you think? Many manifestations of the divine glory. How many times did he ascend Mount Sinai? How many times did the angel communicate with him? How many things, how many episodes happened in Moses' life where he saw a manifestation of the glory of God? And yet the funny thing is that right at the end of his life, when Moses wrote up all of his experiences, he came back to one thing that he'd never forgotten, one moment in his life that he would never forget. And that's in Deuteronomy chapter 33. And this is what he says in the very last month of his life. And we know it was the last month because we're told expressly, are we not, that that's when he wrote the book of Deuteronomy. And in Deuteronomy chapter 33, when Moses reflects upon all that he'd learned and all that he'd come to understand, he would say this in that particular passage concerning the blessings upon the tribes. Moses said this concerning Joseph in Deuteronomy 33 and verse 13. And of Joseph he said, blessed of Yahweh be his land, for the precious things of heaven, for the dew and for the deep that coucheth beneath, and for the precious fruits brought forth by the sun, and for the precious things brought forth by the moon, and for the chief things of the ancient mountains, and for the precious things of the lasting hills, and for the precious things of the earth and the fullness thereof, and for the good will of him that dwelt in the bush, says Moses. Oh, now what an interesting phrase. For the good will of him that dwelt in the bush, let the blessing come upon the head of Joseph and upon the top of the head of him that was separated from his brethren. And of course, the thing is, you see, that Joseph was the brightest flame of manifestation among all the sons, the greatest type of Christ. Joseph was preeminently God manifest among his brethren. Let the blessing come upon the top of the head of him that was separated from his brethren. And that one, the one who represents more than any other of the sons of Jacob, our Lord Jesus Christ, crowned with the Nazarite principles of separation, let the good will of him that dwelt in the bush come upon this man. And that's the way Moses describes this blessing, you see. What a lovely phrase, the good will of him that dwelt in the bush. And when you think about it, that's an interesting phrase itself, because what it's really saying is that that's where the fire dwells, isn't it? Him that dwelt in the bush is the angel, and the angel is the flame, and so the flame dwells in the bush. And the bush is not consumed because the flame dwells there forever, you see. And so this is a reference, finally, to the eternal flame of immortality, the burning that always glows and never ends, because the bush cannot be consumed, because it ever burns with the principles of divine glory and majesty and manifestation, because Yahweh is in this place. And because Yahweh is in the place and dwells in the bush, the ground is holy because God is there. Do you know, brothers and sisters, that's the destiny of all of us, to be part of the flame in the bush, to burn forever in that way. Now, it's a funny thing, you know, but when our early brethren wrote the statement of faith, and each one of us has a copy of that, it's in the copy of our own Christchurch North Christadelphian Ecclesia's statement of faith and constitution. I wonder if you know that this is how our statement of faith begins. This is how our pioneer brethren began to write up the statement of faith. That the only true God is he who was revealed to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob by angelic visitation and vision, and to Moses at the flaming bush, unconsumed, it says. In brackets. And our pioneer brethren were so impressed with that idea of the everlasting splendor of the divine manifestation in the bush, and so longed to be associated with that principle of immortality, that at the very beginning of our statement of faith, they put that little word in, that God was revealed to Moses at the flaming bush, brackets, unconsumed. And they took that word right out of Exodus 3 and put it into our statement of faith. That was what our early brethren wanted to be associated with, the bush that's never consumed by the burning of the flame. It's right at the beginning of our statement of faith, brothers and sisters. It's a marvellous thing. It's what impressed our early brethren. That's what they wanted to be part of. So let's learn the lesson concerning manifestation. That if we want to be part of the flame of God, and we want to belong to the bush that is never consumed, we need to go to the wilderness, that we might see those things and learn to be part of them. In the words of a hymn that puts it this way, Lord of all being, throned afar, thy glory flames from sun and star, center and soul of each of every sphere, yet to each seeking heart, how near. Grant us thy truth to make us free, and kindling hearts that burn for thee, lit by the word with heavenly flame, whose glow shall glorify thy name.